The times demand ever more from us, only to return ever less to us. One farmer suggested we consider a single straw of grain, and from it learn to grow nothing and harvest everything. And so we ask, is it possible to grow nothing and harvest everything?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1031st edition of the Food Chain right here on GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Frankfurt who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
My pleasure always.
Jason, I have a question for you. Do you think it's possible to grow nothing and harvest everything?
I think that would require a lot of finesse.
A lot of finesse. Well, I bet it does too. Folks, thanks to the U.S. Navy, I was, at the time, freed from my work as a teenage herbicide in Montana and riding a bicycle in wide-eyed fascination across the Japanese countryside. The object of my fascination was the contrasting use of space between the Montana of my recent past and the Japan of my present. Montana was a lot of land and a very few people. Consequently, Montanans always enjoyed the freedom to spread things out a bit. But in Japan, very little land, very and a lot of people. Japanese always had to compress their activities into much smaller spaces. And so everywhere I looked on my bike rides through the Japanese countryside, I saw space-intensive farms. It was as if those farmers of 40 centuries, as F.H. King called them, had somehow managed to take my grandfather's 320-acre farm and compress it into like 3 acres. So I became an ardent admirer of the space-intensive production technologies of Asia and the potential those technology presented to farms serving the metropolitan areas of the world. But later, I learned of a new farming technology coming out of Japan that seemed to turn everything I thought I understood about intensity upside down. It was called the one straw revolution, or more simple, do nothing farming. And so today, standing on my head, I ask, can we grow nothing and harvest everything? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have the guy who should know all about it because he wrote the book and translated the book and met the man himself. He is Larry Korn, author of The One Straw Revolutionary. Larry, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you aboard. Well, is it possible to grow, to do nothing and harvest everything?
Well, that's a very poetic way of putting it. Mr. Fukuoka did quite a bit of work because he had an acre and a half of rice fields, and he grew rice and a crop of winter grain in the same field every year. And he also had a 10-acre citrus orchard. So with that much land, I mean, you're busy doing something all the time.
All the time.
But what he objected to was unnecessary work. So when he developed his technique, he examined the agriculture that you described, the intensive agriculture of traditional Japanese agriculture, and he went about it in a different way. He said, instead of doing this and doing that, how about if we didn't do this and that? For example, why are we plowing? Why are we flooding the rice field? Some very basic questions. Why are we making compost? And eventually he decided that none of those things was necessary.
And thus the do-nothing farming.
That's the do-nothing farming part, mm-hmm. Yes.
Well,
it's not a no-work. It's not a no-work. It's a do-nothing do-nothing in the sense of do no unnecessary work.
And then, of course, that's probably hugely antithetical to the way we do just about everything here in the West. We, you know, we overdo everything, it seems, and continually get less and less for it. So the notion of do-nothing farming or natural farming or the one straw farming is kind of fascinating to those of us in the West. And that's the subject that we're going to pick up today. Masanobu Fukuoka. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Masanobu Fukuoka, the One Straw Revolution. You, Larry Korn, were intimately involved in bringing the One Straw Revolution to the West. And how did you find yourself as in part of this One Straw Revolution?
Well, it was a, believe me, this is the furthest thing from my mind that my life would be involved with plants and soil and natural farming. I grew up in Los Angeles and was always interested in Asia, studied Asian studies at Berkeley, and then when I graduated, I just decided to go to Asia to see what it was like, just a trip for adventure, and I met some people there who were the counterparts to our Back to the Land movement. This was 1971, and I hitchhiked from one commune to the other. These were places in beautiful and remote areas in Japan, and most of them were agricultural, and I learned the joy of living in a natural area and growing your own food and working in the fields, and especially, for some reason, the soil spoke to me. Anyway, my travels eventually led me to Fukuoka's farm, and it was such a interesting example of a completely different way of agriculture that I decided to stay. He was accepting students, like interns, to stay in these rustic huts up in the orchard, and I stayed at his farm for 2 years.
And thus you became very intimately acquainted with him and his philosophy and his notions of one straw agriculture. But then there was more. You helped him bring his book to life, right?
That's correct. While I was there, this was 1975 now, the One Straw Revolution came out in Japanese. And Mr. Fukuoka was not, you know, his fields looked so different, his philosophy was so different. He was largely ignored in Japan and treated like an eccentric. And some of the other students knew the Back to the Land movement and the environmental movement were just starting up in the United States and all over the world. And we thought that his message was so important to get outside of Japan that we decided to translate his book into English. And I was the one that was brought it to the United States, found a publisher, Rodale Press, who was putting out the best books of this type at the time. And the book became an immediate success, and it's since been translated into more than 20 languages, and he's well known now all over the world.
Just like that, right?
Just like that.
Just like that. There he is. Wow. So that's been quite an adventure to you. You also brought him to the United States, correct? Or helped shepherd him around the United States,
yeah,
as it were?
Well, once the One Straw Revolution came out in English, he started getting invitations to travel all over the world. He had never been outside of Japan until that time, and the first invitation was to come to the United States, and I arranged a six-week tour of California, New York, and New England, and I traveled with him and translated for him and so forth, and then he came again. That was in 1979. He came again in 1986. And also went to those same places and also added Oregon and Washington. So I got a chance to see, you know, it's fascinating. He was so tuned into nature and then but he had only been in Japan. So then you take him and plop him down in California or in Oregon or New England, and just to hear his impressions, it's just fascinating.
You know, that's an interesting notion too, because as a student of Chinese. I always found it interesting when you run across a principle that evolved in Chinese history and had its counterpart also in the West. So you'd think, well, here's something that evolved in two different worlds separately, so there must be some kind of truth in it. And I suspect having him see what we see every day, you know, probably was some pretty interesting revelations coming from him then. Folks, this is a Food Chain Radio program. Today we're going to have a lot of fun talking about a Japanese farmer, Masunobu Fukuoka, who brought a whole different way of looking at the world and looking at agriculture, certainly, to the West in his One Straw Revolution. The book, One Straw Revolutionary, A Look at Masunobu Fukuoka by Larry Korn. And you're invited to participate today. If you have any questions about this really interesting notion, pick up your phone and join us. We're at 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. We will be right back with Larry Korn.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, this from The One Straw Revolution by Masunobu Fukuoka, as found in One Straw Revolutionary by Larry Korn. The usual way to go about developing a method is to ask, how about trying that? Or how about trying that? This is modern agriculture, and it only results in making the farmer busier. My way was just the opposite. I was aiming at a pleasant, natural way of farming, which results in making the work easier instead of harder. How about not doing that? Or how about not doing this? That was my way of thinking. I ultimately reached the conclusion that there was no need to plow, no need to apply fertilizer, no need to make compost, no need to use insecticide. When you get right down to it, there are very few agricultural practices that are really necessary. Wow, that is just about exactly the opposite of what you find as agriculture here in the United States. The One Straw Revolution by Masunobu Fukuoka. Who was Mr. Fukuoka, Larry?
He grew up, he was born in 1913, and he passed away about 6 years ago at the age of 95. He grew up in a typical farming village on the island of Shikoku. So he was part of this traditional Japanese agriculture. His family grew rice and had a citrus orchard. But he was trained as a plant pathologist, and he traveled to Yokohama for his first job, which was at the plant inspection station where they inspected plants that were coming in and going out of Japan. And while he was there, when he was 25 years old, he had a vision or some inspiration.
An epiphany.
Mm-hmm. Where he saw nature, as he said, he saw nature revealed in its true form. And he saw that nature was completely interconnected, and with all of the everything working in total harmony and everything for the greater good and providing their best service. And when people get involved in the process and think that they can improve upon nature, then side effects, problems, are inevitable. And then we deal with those problems. And, of course, that creates more problems and greater problems. And this goes on and on until basically we find ourselves in the position we are today, where almost everything we're doing is mitigating the problems of things that we've done before.
And there, so it's he kind of, It's kind of an Adam and Eve story, is it not? You know, everything was just fine until Eve talked Adam into biting into the apple, and then all hell broke loose, and it's been that way ever since.
Yes, and in this case, I'm jumping ahead a little bit
sure.
here. But let me finish this story about. So what Mr. Fukuoka decided to do was to go back to his. Nobody could understand or were not interested in what he had to say. So he went back to his family farm.
Are you there? Hello? I think we just lost a bit. We'll call him back and pick it up. So, folks, we're talking about the One Straw Revolution, a concept derived from a Japanese farmer by the name of Masunobu Fukuoka on the island of Shikoku in Japan. Masunobu came up with this incredible idea by which we wouldn't have to do anything to be able to farm. And so that's what we're looking at. How is it possible to do nothing and be able to farm everything? Which is the concept that he pulled together. I think we've got somebody on. Are we there?
Yes, we are. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. So I was thinking about what you said, how nobody would listen to him. And I guess, you know, we've all met people who have wonderful ideas that you listen to them, you think, that's really a great idea, but has, like, no practical, you know, place in this world. So what do you bring it here for? So we kind of lose track of that and move on. And I've imagined people listening to him, you know, telling everybody that the world is perfect, that we don't need to do anything. And they probably looked at him and shook their head and moved right along. And so he went back to his own farm, right?
That's right. You know, at the time, this was in the 1930s, people were thinking that science and technology was going to create a wonderful world in which there would be abundance and people with total leisure. And so what he was saying seemed like a step backwards or not in line with what everyone was thinking. So his idea was to apply this thinking to agriculture and thereby demonstrate its usefulness. And so 25 years later, when I came to his farm and he had, you know, worked out his system, he was getting yields that were comparable or greater than the neighbors, but he didn't use any of the modern technology. He used no machinery, didn't use chemicals, he didn't plow, and the soil improved year after year in his fields, while the neighbors were using all of those things, getting equal yields, but they had to build the factories to make the tractors and then pull out the fossil fuels and spread chemicals and create pollution, and the soil ran down every year. So he did prove that point, the practical benefit of his way of thinking.
So there it was for everybody to see. Did everybody look
exactly.
at it, though?
And not in Japan. He said that his neighbors would walk by the fields and then pretend that he wasn't there. He was a pariah in a way. His fields looked, they were not the straight rows of clean fields like Japan is so famous for. It was a riot of rice and some weeds and straw on the surface and a permanent ground cover of white clover, and there were insects everywhere.
Ooh, so this was the most frightening thing in the world to a farmer, right? There's bugs on the ground.
And it doesn't look neat. It does not look neat. You know, and we still, you know, here we can see the, for example, the permaculture people these days put in a permaculture garden in their front yard, and the neighbors with their lawns and ornamental plants look at that and they go, what a mess.
But there
so
it is.
You know, this is not just in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thinking is all over.
Well, I think, you know, with respect to cultivation, everybody likes this sense of orderliness. I've talked with one flower farmer. Two gals were farming flowers and as neighbors. One of them, you know, had her garden in you know, the flowers look like little soldiers marching down the garden bed, you know. And the other one was, I think, a fan of Masanobu, because her garden was a riot of everything. You know, it was just a mess, but very, very productive still. So how, when he went back to his farm from being in the city, was everything working then, or how did, where did he start? Because this it seems like such an incredibly intense, natural way of doing things, but it seems like, how do you get there?
Well, that was his challenge when he came back, and not only did he nobody had ever tried anything like this before, and he had no human teacher that could show him. And not only that, but the soil in the orchard had been mistreated. The topsoil was gone. He started with hard subsoil, and the fields had been already plowed. And so he not only had to develop the system, but he had to rehabilitate what was there to repair the damage that people had done before he got there.
So
he did that by...
Don't tell us how we did it yet, because we have to take a quick break. And if you tell them how they did it, then maybe they won't come back. So all you folks out there have to come back to hear how Masanobu Fukuoka turned his dead, dying orchard into this beautiful little natural paradise, where now he doesn't have to do much to harvest everything. This is the Food Chain Radio program, Michael Olson. It's the One Straw Revolutionary Book with Larry Korn and you. 831-479-1080 is the call-in number. Join us. Well, when Masanobu Fukuoka went back to the farm to start his One Straw Revolution, it wasn't as if he was going to start from scratch. He had to start from less than scratch, because there was not much left of that farm. The soil had been depleted. The topsoil was gone. Starting from less than scratch, what on earth do you do when you're facing a disaster like that, Larry Korn?
Well, he improved the soil was his first step, and he did that by scattering seeds. He put in a soil-building ground cover of lots of different plants, including deep-rooted plants like dandelion and burdock and daikon, and then mustard family plants, radishes, and alfalfa and buckwheat, and a permanent ground cover of white clover. And then he planted shrubs, nitrogen-fixing shrubs, and he used acacia trees to improve the soil deep down because they fix nitrogen. So what he did was he concentrated on improving the soil and reestablishing diversity, a diversity of plants in the orchard.
Go ahead.
Well, he mixed the seeds of all of these different plants together and put them in clay pellets, and he just scattered them around. He didn't want to be the one to design the orchard. He wanted nature to design the orchard.
You know, you talk about putting the seeds in clay ball. Tell people the significance of that act.
Well,
because it's kind of emulated by most modern seed companies now, and it gets right down to it in their chemical ways. But tell us about...
Well, nature essentially puts seeds in seed balls by the coating, you know, the pods and and so forth. And he actually did that. He sowed seeds in the pods a lot. But then the clay pellets, it's a technique that's been used for hundreds of years, but was largely forgotten until he brought it back and reminded people of it. And what it really improves the survivability of the seeds, because they've got something to work with. They've got some nutrients. It holds the seed there until it's just the right time to germinate, and then it gives them a little survival packet. So, but still, when you just scatter seeds onto bare ground, many of the seeds don't survive, but the ones that do really like where they are, and then they reseed themselves and naturalize, and pretty soon you get some really strong growing plants.
And that was the way he chose to rebuild his soil, which was essentially sterile, or, you know, on its way to being sterile. And, you know, I just think of Western ways with soil. I mean, we're now coming to the into the world of organic agriculture where people actually start thinking about soil. But, you know, a lot of conventional soil or agriculture treat soil as if it's an inert medium, and they almost don't want to have any form of biological life in it at all. And so his way is really just the opposite. How does it compare with, like, organic soil technologies?
Well, the approach is different. The approach is, I am going to make that jump right now, that what Mr. Fukuoka was doing, it was all he was doing was interacting with the landscape in the same way that indigenous people were all over the world until about 8 or 10,000 years ago. And then for some reason, people got the idea that we're special creatures, that we can act any way we like, and we can ignore natural law and natural limits. And so this idea of control came in, that we are controlling instead of forming a partnership with nature. So all of the things that you're talking about, treating the soil like just an inert substance, or plowing and planting crops in monoculture, or even the permaculture creating a design that emulates nature, these are all forms of control. And this is the way of thinking that is new to human experience, only the last, like, 8,000 years. Before that, we interacted in a completely different way. We were partners. We lived among the other animals and the plants. And we were grateful because nature was providing all that we needed, all the food, all of the materials for shelter, for all the things that we needed to live. And by trying things and seeing how nature reacted, people gradually developed a way of life that was quite secure and abundant, and they hardly had to work to do it. Now, with our control approach, we are hobbling nature by everything that we do, so we're cutting off the natural supply of abundance. And we have to do it all ourselves. And so that's where the work comes in. We're working harder. The more agriculture develops, the harder we're working. But we've substituted fossil fuel for a lot of that work, mm-hmm. for the human work.
Well, all of our technology is kind of designed to get people off the land and into the city. And where we hang around and look at computer screens and stuff like that, but it seems like
the energy invested is actually greater when you figure
do all
human
the equations,
hours,
yeah,
and then yeah.
So, and looking at the one straw revolution or natural farming or do nothing farming. There was work there. It took a lot for him to build the soil. I mean, it took seasons upon seasons upon seasons, right?
Yes. So that's something that the indigenous people didn't have to do. So he started, as you said, from less than zero, and he had to take that extra step. That took him about 20 years. Once the diversity was developed in the orchard, he didn't have to worry about insect control because of the natural balance. And once the permanent ground cover was established, he didn't have to fertilize. He didn't have to plow. He stopped pruning the orchard trees. And pretty much he did very simple tasks, and he was able to manage a 10-acre orchard on his own for many, many years. Except he needed help at the harvest. The harvest is always the most labor-intensive of any agriculture. But it's a lot less work. You know, when the Europeans came and saw the Indians, just seemed like they were
hanging around,
plenty of free time. Hanging around, they thought they were lazy, but actually it was that they just didn't need to do as much work.
as the Europeans' way of doing things. Interesting. Wow, folks, this is, and so here you have the image of this Japanese farmer hanging around his farm doing nothing when all of his neighbors are working and pushing and shoving and plowing and spraying and everything. And when the harvest comes, he has every bit as much as they do, only he hasn't had to do much of anything. So it really is do-nothing agriculture. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to the phones, 831-479-1080. Love to hear what you have to say about the One Straw Revolution. Any application here? What do you think? 831-479-1080 is the phone number. We will be right back after these very important messages with Larry Korn. Well, folks, the times demand ever more from us, only to return ever less to us. One farmer, Masanobu Fukuoka in Japan, some years ago suggested we consider a single straw of grain, and from that single straw, learn how to grow nothing and harvest everything with natural farming, with do-nothing farming, by cooperating with nature instead of bulldozing nature. That's pretty much it, isn't it, Larry, about learning how to cooperate?
Yes, it is, and it's approaching nature with a sense of gratitude because we have... We're here in an unfamiliar place, essentially, and we have everything that we need. It's just given to us, so they were so thankful for that. And whatever they did in interacting with nature, they were always careful not to damage the source of where this sustenance was coming from. We don't seem to care at all about that anymore. We just want more, and we want to grow more and take more.
And it always seems to cost more to get more, but it even costs more than more to get more as we go along. Let's go to the phones, folks. 831-479-1080 is the phone number. Let's talk with Wendy. Wendy, welcome to the Food Chain. You've got Larry Korn on the line.
Oh, well, thank you both. I was wondering how this the Fukuoka's single straw technique would work in a more Mediterranean-like climate like ours, where it's not so much just controlling the plant growth and limiting rot and dealing with the incredible amount of pests that we don't have. Is there a way to deal with it? Because we are in such trouble with our drought, and I'm watching all these gardens that I sold the plants to dying. It's horrendous.
Well, that's a great question. Would it work here, Larry Korn?
Natural farming will work anywhere, and we know that because indigenous people lived everywhere across the planet. But they lived in smaller tribes, and they got to know their area very carefully and intimately, and they worked out a way that they could make it work where they lived. But, of course, in an area with less rainfall, there will be fewer people because they have to live within the carrying capacity. But as far as the technique, boy, you just have to go with the philosophy and the approach and work it out on your own.
Yeah, because we have giant redwoods, and they do incredible things. But trying to become friends with our poison oak is really difficult, but you find some really magical things about it. I wanted to bring that up, that you might not want to do this, the techniques described here, because we don't have the rot capacity. And a lot of those mustards and things like that can become very invasive, and we have a terrible acacia problem. But learning how to use the acacia, which we have no problem growing here, would be nice.
Well, you'd have to substitute different plants that are appropriate to the area. What Mr. Fukuoka, all the mustard and the, you know, he had that's appropriate to where he lived. He worked out a way to do this where he lived. Now, it's true that he had some pretty favorable conditions. He had 60 inches of rainfall, and most of it came during the growing season.
Right.
So,
like,
you know, that, and he had deep soils and rich volcanic soil, even though it had been eroded. But you just have to say, well, take the principles and the idea of it and adapt it by using plants that are appropriate and techniques that are appropriate to the area.
I hope some of the people around here, we have a wonderful garden program at UCSC, and I hope that they can learn a lot from the program. It's been very educational. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Larry.
On Fukuoka's on second visit to the United States, he came to UC Santa Cruz and gave a talk, and he toured those gardens, by the way.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's nice. The Chadwick Garden is just amazing up there. And the organic garden is always fun. They have a wonderful orchard program up there. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for the call, Wendy. You know, when you talk about how simple it is, it sounds like it takes a lot of smarts to be able to cooperate with nature to the extent that you need to cooperate. Larry?
It takes sophistication. I won't say smarts. In fact, it's the opposite of smarts, because smarts is trying to figure things out. You say, what if I did this? Then you're back into the what if I did this and what if I did that, and you're using the intellect, which, you know, we relied on intuitive understanding.
Yeah, it was before. That apple again, right?
And now we're here stuck with, you know, trying to understand everything. And then that's, of course, the extension of that is science, which breaks nature apart into bits and pieces and studies it and then tries to put it back together. And it's a artificial way of understanding. So it's not smarts, it's intuition, and it takes a shift in a way of thinking. That's the crucial thing, is that if you are relying on figuring things out, and then you're going to be very difficult to practice natural farming.
Well, let's go to Tony. Tony, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, Larry Korn, and you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. This is, you know me. Anyway, as soon as I heard you talk about the pot full of seeds, I immediately thought of the original pods full of seeds that were ferried from island to island and spread seeds around. And bird poop. Birds would eat something, take care of the seeds, and they would drop these little pellets of seeds. And I think those were the original clay seed pods. Someone figured that out. And they were emulating the action of the bird's intestines.
And probably that's the cleverness or the intuition of Masanobu Fukuoka.
I have one other thing, though. I have a question.
You have
about
to hold it until we get back from the break, then, okay? Can you do that? Okay,
sure.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Right back. Do stay tuned. Can we work less and harvest more? Is it really possible for do-nothing farming to make a big difference in the world of industrial agriculture? Wow. Michael Olson with Larry Korn, The One Straw Revolutionary is the book, The Philosophy and Work of Masanobu Fukuoka. And Tony, you want to finish up here?
Yes, this is slightly off the subject, but it does have to do with Larry Korn's name. My mother was a governess for a very well-to-do Korn family in Detroit, Michigan, and she had to quit that to marry my father. But when they got married, they insisted on this beautiful little blonde girl, Clara Korn, be their flower girl at their wedding at St. Stanislaus Church, and that was not to be according to the church hierarchy because she was a Jewish girl. We didn't want any Jews involved in Catholic ceremonies. But my parents stood their ground, saying they would get married at the city hall if this wasn't possible. So they changed the policy, and Clara Korn was the first Jewish person ever involved in a Catholic ceremony, as far as we know in Detroit Catholic history. So I was wondering if it's possible that Larry was then had a grandmother or a great aunt named Clara Korn.
Well, you're right. It is off the subject, but what's the answer, Larry?
No, the answer is that I've got relatives in Michigan. And have for since about 1940, but no one named Clara as far as I know.
There you go, Tony. Thanks for the call. Really appreciate it. Well, folks, what do you think out there? Is it possible to bring this technology of natural farming, not organic farming, not anything like organic farming, actually? It's natural farming. completely cooperating with nature as you find it where you're at. I would suspect that natural farming would really limit the size of the population. Larry?
Oh, gee, that just depends. It's hard to know directly. But what to practice natural farming, if society decided to use this as their primary way of producing food, then people would need to move out of the cities and farm on small plots scattered everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it is designed mainly for relatively small areas. That's true. It works best that way.
And it's also designed for people who have the proclivity or the ability to really get close with nature, too. I mean, because to cooperate to the extent you're talking about, you have to be a cooperative person.
That's true. And that's why the last chapter of my book is entitled, it's a quote from Fukuoka-san, "Without natural people, there can be no natural farming."
Well, I have
difficult.
Go ahead. We have a natural person on the line, Rory. Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Thank you. I'd just like to know, how did Mr. Fukuoka?
Yes.
How did he deal with the natural rodents like pocket gophers and other little critters that might want in on his bounty?
Good question.
He didn't really worry about them because there was a natural balance. There were other creatures that kept them under control. But that wasn't the case when he had to do certain things when he first moved to the farm until nature became whole again and could, so you had natural balances. He had to do certain things that he didn't have to do later.
And it's all in the One Straw Revolutionary, the philosophy and work of Masanobu Fukuoka by Larry Korn. Larry, thank you so much for joining us on the food chain. Folks, I guess we'll file this under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have what's in that food. Thank you for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.